Okay. So, I have asked someone who I've heard speak before, but is a wonderful speaker and a great person that I see on meetings regularly. Usually the Wednesday night Santa Barbara meeting is where I see this fellow. And he's spoken for Tesnua before, but it's always good to get another recording. You can speak as long as you like about any topic or anything you wish to speak about. So without further ado, I would like to introduce to you Ralph, our speaker, and let me unmute you. All right, over to you.
Thank you, Bridget, and thank you, everybody, for showing up. My name is Ralph, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I am happy to be sober today. I'm happy to have this opportunity to join you folks, to get to see some new faces. And I see some folks that I have met before, actually, beside Bridget, that I have met in the meetings, Bridget and Sonny. I think I just saw Bill in Las Vegas also. Good to see you, Bill. I'm happy you're here. I'm happy everybody's here. Thank you for inviting me, Bridget. And I'm just going to talk about my experience briefly with alcohol and what brought me to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and what kept me. I got sober, or my last drunk, I should say, was on August 3rd of 1999. That's when I had my last drink. I got busted for drunk driving that night. It was not my first; it was my nth. I stopped counting. I think it was probably the seventh or the eighth drunk driving arrest that I have unfortunately suffered. And I was sentenced to a whole bunch of things, including 18 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to do a court card, and one of those guys who was court ordered to come to AA. And because of the experience that I've undergone in AA, I stayed and just celebrated on August 4th of this year, a couple of months ago, 25 years of continuous sobriety. And for that, I am truly grateful to all the men and women who come to Alcoholics Anonymous and who have helped me stay sober one day at a time. I won't bore you with too long and a drunkalogue. I suffered tremendously as a result of my excessive drinking. I just couldn't stop. I tried umpteen times to stop. I didn't go to rehab. I didn't. I probably should have, but I didn't go to rehab or detox, and I did not go to Alcoholics Anonymous either. But I may have attended some meetings that were court ordered in the past, but my attorneys usually, when they help me fill out a form or forge signatures on cards and turn it over, and that was the end of that. The only time that I remember attending AA is after the accident and the drunk driving arrest of August 3rd of 99. That's when I remember that Alcoholics Anonymous was mandatory. There was a probation officer involved, and I had to get court cards signed and turned over to him on a weekly basis. And I also attended face-to-face meeting and group meetings that dealt with drug and alcohol, and had hundreds of hours of community service. I did hundreds of hours of work furlough in lieu of jail. I ended up doing some work, manual work, in the Twin Towers prison, a county jail of downtown Los Angeles. And so the program of behavior modification, or cognitive behavior modification, really was contained in the court order itself. In addition to losing my driving privilege, or suspending my driving privilege for 2 years, the judge mandated that I attend these face-to-face group meetings, community service work, and Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Literally, every single day of the week, I had to do one or the other, and have court cards signed and turned over to a probation officer. So, as a result of that strict and very severe program, I was essentially forced into a new behavior than the one that I had been accustomed to, for the previous 32 years of drinking it. Just to mention a couple of things about how bad my drinking had gotten. In May of 1983, a son was born to me and my wife. And I remember after his birth, his birth, I was present at the moment he came out and stuff. It had a psychic change effect on me. I was present and it really affected me emotionally dramatically. And I honestly thought that I really needed to stop drinking, but I had gotten to the point by that time, this is 1983, by that time I had gotten to the point where I had given up on myself. I no longer attempted to stop drinking. I thought it was a waste of time because I had failed so many times before. So what does a responsible businessman do when faced with that kind of the dilemma? I went ahead and bought a life insurance policy to pay off the balance of the mortgage on the house and to leave a stipend to for my wife, who by then would be my widow. I figured I was going to die pretty soon in a car accident, most likely, or of liver failure or a heart attack or something. So I bought a life insurance policy to essentially to take care of my financial responsibility toward my progeny and my wife, my widow. That was what I thought was a responsible thing that a man should do. Stopping drinking, though it entered my mind, was really out of the question because I had attempted and failed so many times before. I had quite a few drunk driving episodes after that, and car accidents, and some very sad and sordid stories that I won't bore you with of drunken stupor. One of my buddies, one of my associates, I had a business in LA, and I had three partners, so there were four of us. One of them was my drinking buddy. He passed away. Actually, he passed away on my sobriety date on August 4th, just about 5 years ago. Poor guy. I thought I would go before him, actually, because I think I drank more than he did. But I remember after I stopped drinking, he used to remind me how many times I tried to do a 12-step work on him or ask him if he was interested in stopping, and he scoffed. He says, "What the heck is wrong with you, Ralph? Just because you got caught and you stopped doesn't mean everybody should." And I agree with him. Not everybody should, but he didn't want to stop. But he reminded me many times that he would ask me. We would be leaving a bar, which was right next to our office, and I would be very tipsy by that time. And he would ask me, he said, "Ralph, let's walk to the Bistro Garden, which is a nice fancy restaurant in Beverly Hills. Let's go over there and have dinner, and we're going to meet some clients." And he said many times, I told him, "Jerry, I'm too drunk to walk. I'll drive." So I did that. I actually I opted not to walk and be seen walking tipsy. I figured I'll just drive there and nobody will see me walking. And obviously, that kind of logic or lack of logic and insanity eventually got caught, not once, but many times. Anyway, so the sentence was now the night of the arrest is really interesting because it was just another night, like any other night, actually. Just a day. The day started the same way with my intent to have lunch at the office. We'd buy Japanese or Chinese or Mexican food in a nice cafeteria in the office. But I didn't. I went and had some liquid lunch and got accustomed to walking to the next door. I keep calling it a bar. It's really a very nice, very fancy restaurant called Colette on the ground floor of a hotel in Beverly Hills, which was just a block from my office. And so I walk there on a daily basis and I drink Grand Marnier. That's the last thing I did. Last binge was on Grand Marnier. And I get tipsy and I forget about all the promises I made to myself the night before. But that night we did go to a restaurant in LA here in Beverly Hills. And Jerry and I and a couple of clients, and again, to this day, and it's been over 25 years now, I don't recall where my car was, but apparently I left the restaurant. Not apparently, I did leave the restaurant, found my car, and drove it. And in a complete blackout, and I still can't remember how I did that or how I found the car or where it was. But in any event, I got into a nasty accident solo. There was nobody else involved. It was just me and a concrete barrier, which was indicating and protecting the entrance to a construction site on in Westwood. And I totaled the car. When I came to, I was across the street, sitting on a curb, on the curb, on Wilshire Boulevard, a major thoroughfare in Los Angeles. And I was looking, raising my head to look at my car. It was up in flames. It was about 11:30 at night. The car was in flames, and there were some firefighters who were dosing the car with foam to put out the fire. And a police, a motorcycle cop came, and he was told that I was the driver. He came, he asked me if it was my car. I said yes. And he asked me if I would, if I had been drinking, and I said yes. I was having dinner and had some drinks, and so he gave me a field sobriety test, which I flunked royally, of course. And he handcuffed me and had me sit down, and he said the patrol car will be coming to pick you up. And I sat there, and I was shaking my head. I was trying to wake up, trying to realize the predicament I had put myself in, you know, for the nth time. And it's just unbelievably, you know, in the big books they say the incomprehensible demoralization. I was so totally demoralized, so totally defeated. But a patrol car did come, and a man and a lady, forgot which one of them was driving, but they threw me in the back seat of the patrol car, and were taking me to jail. And I experienced something in the back seat of that patrol car. For one thing, I could feel the wind. This is in August of 1999. It was a warm night. The car was moving fairly fast. It's the west side of town, and the wind was hitting the back of my earlobes. And I was overcome with a sensation of peace, of total, and I don't know where the hell that came from, but I was feeling like I was very light, like I was at peace with myself, and that I was feeling that I was being freed from a prison, that I was being freed from a calamity that I had constructed with my own hands and my own habit, and that things are going to be better, that tomorrow is going to be a brighter day, that my future is going to be all right. Now that feeling, personally, I believe, is the result of the amygdala in the back of my brain, in the base of my brain, part of the reptilian part of the brain, or reptilian part of the brain, was the amygdala, or the fight or flight gland kicking in, and essentially making a choice, pre-reflective choice. It did not involve my frontal cortex or my thinking at all. It was all felt experience and lived experience. I was essentially opting for life as opposed to death by suicide, which I was committing one glass at a time. And I'm pretty sure that that was my liver cells, my kidney cells, my bladder cells, my brain cells, my lung cells, my heart cells were screaming in unison, rebellious against the son of a bitch who was killing them. And they were opting for life, basically, as opposed to death. And it was not an armistice or a temporary ceasefire. It was outright peace. And that's the sensation that I felt. And that's the sensation that I felt, that I was actually thinking it's going to be good. Again, didn't involve thinking it. But my friends in AA, who are religious, who are believers in metaphysics and in the hereafter and souls and stuff, they tell me that that was the grace of God that touched you in the back seat of that car. And as an agnostic, scientifically minded skeptic, I don't buy that. I think it is, whatever the name of it is, I think it is truly survival instinct that actually conquered and found a gap or an opening, a portal that opened up in my existence, in my consciousness, and lived through before my ego came to and began rationalizing and behaving. Now, mind you, the next morning when I came to in the Venice jail, in the police station, when I realized what had happened, where the heck I was, my first thought was, why the hell did I take Wilshire Boulevard? I should have taken Olympic, or I should have crossed through the canyons, you know, and as if I had taken the canyons, I wouldn't be here talking to you tonight, but I wouldn't be an alcoholic. You know, it's obviously, you know, minutes and seconds and meters and inches that make a difference. But I am grateful to whatever it is in Mother Nature that actually got a hold of me and woke me up and made me realize that I was killing myself. And I'm still talking about myself. I was actually killing relationships, close and distant, with my my closest ones, my wife and my daughter and my son, but also my brothers. I got two of them. I had two of them. I only have one left. And my five sisters. I only have four left now. And everybody else, my friends that I grew up with. I completely lost them as a result of my drinking and my alcohol consumption. Unfortunately for me, many of those friendships are lost. They're lost forever, because many have moved away, many have died, and I haven't had a chance to rekindle those friendships. I have, since I gotten sober, rekindled my relationships with other people, because my alcoholic behavior has shrunk my milieu to down to almost nothing. Very, very few things. So when I got sentenced to Alcoholics Anonymous, and my attorney, a guy called Adrian Marinovich, wonderful Ukrainian American, originally from Canada, from Toronto, Adrian was. He passed away about a decade ago of brain tumor, very, very young. He was my drinking buddy also. But I had him on retainer, you know, so to speak. I mean, every time I got into a bind, I called him, and he was a very smooth talker. And he was able to talk to judges. He knew lots of judges and city attorneys and prosecutors and stuff. And he was able to wind down many of my drunk driving, were whittled down to unsafe lane change or speeding or something of that nature. But many of them involved alcohol, so they were a problem for me. In my last conviction, they pulled everything, and many of them were tainted with drinking. So the judge was very severe when it came to that. But because Adrian told me in the halls of the courthouse, he said, "Ralph, I'm going to try to get you the best deal possible with this city attorney, but she's really, really very mean, and she's has all your record." And shortly before I was in court, there was a case of a drunk driver who killed a whole bunch of people. And apparently it's because the city did not prosecute him severely enough. And so that was in the news. So the courts and the judges were going to be very serious with drunk drivers like me. And it was very bad timing for me. Or, you know, it was just the way things worked out. So Adrian was aware of that, and he said, and he told me about it before. So he said, I'm going to do the best I can for you. But he said, you're going to have plenty of time to cogitate over your fate and over your problem. And he says, eventually you will come to the point where you will realize that your problem is much, much deeper than alcohol, that alcohol is but a symptom of your drinking, of your problems. And hopefully you'll be able to get in touch with that part of yourself, inside yourself, that you'll need to correct in order to be able to live without having to abuse alcohol. It's kind of funny that he would tell me that. To my knowledge, he was never a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We drank together for a long time, and, but he did say that. I came to find out later on, actually at his funeral, and we had a very good memorial service for him, that he had really, even though he was a lawyer, and did very well for himself financially as a result, but he actually did have some incredible experiences as a humanist, and he joined. Self-Realization Fellowship, SRF, which is probably it's here on the West Coast, but it's probably in other places of this globe as well. And in SRF, he had all kinds of connections and love of people. He did one time he was carrying, and his widow told the story. Actually, the guy with whom it happened told the story at his memorial service, at Adrian Memorial Service. He said that one time he was walking, and he said Adrian was going to court, dragging his suitcases behind him, his files. And in the middle of the crosswalk, Adrian told this homeless guy who was coming in the opposite direction, he told him, "Good morning, man." And this African American fellow froze in his footsteps, and he grabbed Adrian by the shoulders, and he told him, "Oh my God, you saw me. You saw me. You said hi. You said good morning to me." And the guy began crying. He said, "I've been homeless for years in downtown LA, and nobody has seen me." He says, "I thought I was invisible." And he said, and apparently a friendship developed from that one incident. That guy showed up at his memorial, at Adrian's memorial service, and talked about it. Adrian, as a result of that, went ahead and bought a van and went around this country, the USA, did about 10,000 miles in his van, and making a film called "A Hero on Every Block." And you can find the film. It's on YouTube. It's free for the taking. They probably asked for donation or something. And it's about homeless people and people who have recovered from drug addiction and alcoholism and stuff like that, or mental disease also, and so on. He's a fascinating guy. Anyway, Adrian told me that, told me, "Raph, you're gonna tap an unsuspected inner resource." That's what on page 567 or 568 of the big book in the Spiritual Experience, which was forced on Bill W. by the free thinkers of Alcoholics Anonymous in 1939. And he said, you will tap an unsuspected inner resource, which you will identify as a power greater than yourself or your higher power or whatever, which religious people call God consciousness. And I think that's probably what happened to me. I have tapped an unsuspected inner resource, which is within me, that actually brought me to the realization that I had a real problem. So I came to AA, and when I saw the God stuff, I honestly thought it was a cult, although it was a Christian cult, as a matter of fact, that is going to try to proselytize me into their holding hands and the Lord's Prayer and stuff. So that was a very, very severe obstacle to cross, you know, when I began reading the steps, and people told me that you have to take the steps, otherwise you can't stay sober. You have to have a sponsor, otherwise you can't stay. You have to find a higher power or a God, otherwise you can't stay. All that stuff. You know. And so I had a severe objection to that. And eventually, my desire, first of all, one guy, and I'll never forget him, he's a friend now, Bob, is in Arkansas. Bob told me, he was a coffee guy behind a coffee counter at the Alano Club. He told me one time, he says, "Raph, how long are you going to be coming to these FN meetings?" So I told him, 18 months, Bob. I got the court card, but he used to sign the court cards for me. I told him, 18 months. And I said, "Oh my God, he killed somebody." I said, "No, just a drunk or a repeat offender drunk." He says, "Okay." He says, "You're going to be coming here for 18 months. And you're gonna be scoffing at everything you listen to, and not take the time to read the literature or to delve into it or to study it." He says, "For 18 months, you're gonna be wasting your time coming here." He says, "You're gonna be just like the idiot who bought a three-bedroom house and continues sleeping on the porch. He says, why don't you enjoy the bedrooms? You paid for them. He said, why don't you enjoy and find out something about Alcoholics Anonymous? Just read the stuff and see what it's all about and investigate it. And if you don't care about it, screw it. Take what works for you and disregard the rest of it. And that kind of made sense. And I had an incident with a lady also, a lady called Jean. I used to, and I was driving a car without a license for 2 years. But I used to pick up this lady and take her to this meeting twice a week. And somebody takes her home later. She told me that she said, you don't seem to be happy. Because I was not drinking, but the desire to drink left me in the back seat of the police car, the patrol car, back on August 3rd of 99. Desire to drink left, period. But I didn't have any program going for me. I was just really just dry and really, really angry. Slamming doors, yelling at my wife and my son and my daughter, and at the office, slamming phones down and stuff. And I was a vision for you, basically. And this lady, Jean, that I was giving the ride to, and I was very polite to her. She was a very nice lady. She was an elderly woman, passed away many years ago, poor soul. She told me, she said, I told her that I'm very unhappy with AA. She said, well, he said, it's not a religious cult. I said, well, yeah, it is a religious cult. What is religious? She said, well, said, you want to get sober. You want to stay sober and be happy. I said, yeah, of course. She said, well, then you need to do the steps. Take the steps, work the steps, study the steps, incorporate them in your life. And I said, what steps? I had been going for about 3 months, never heard the steps, even though they were read at every single meeting. And they were on the walls in that Alano Club. All over the place in English and in Spanish too, and so I told her what steps. And she said, I'll tell you what happened. She said, you have a twin brother living inside you. His name is also Ralph, but he knows he's an alcoholic, and he wants his drink, and you're depriving him. And that Ralph is going to get so angry, he's going to do one of two things: either he's going to kill you, and that's called suicide or alcoholic death, masquerading as an accident or something, or more likely, what's going to happen, Ralph, you're going to pick up and drink. And for us alcoholics, to drink is to die. So take your choice. You can either do that or study the steps and work the steps, and you'll be a happy guy. In addition to that suggestion that Gene made, and I noticed in Alcoholics Anonymous, so many people who had they seem to have joy in their life. They seem to be living with a purpose. They seem to be caring about other people for absolutely no reason whatsoever. They seem to be doing it genuinely just because they are human beings and because they care and they have concern and they have a humanist trait or fiber filament running through them. And that was very appealing to see the kindness of people and the love that they have for each other and the breakers that they go and help them. They show up at hospitals, they go to sober living houses, they go to jails, they go to prisons, they go to detox places and talk to folks. And I thought that was really extremely humanistic and totally, totally unrelated to religion in any shape or form, something I could deal with. And that kind of appeal was very interesting to me, and I decided to go ahead and actually start getting involved in the program and start taking commitments in meetings. That's precisely what I did. I made sure one day that Jean wasn't there, so she can't see me raise my hand and admit that I'm an alcoholic and that she has won the argument. And I raised my hand and said, my name is Ralph, I'm an alcoholic. And I took a newcomer chip and probably a 90-day chip the same meeting because I had been sober for 90 days by that time. And I began to get involved. And I got involved in every meeting by either literature or coffee or setting up the chairs or cleaning after the chairs or picking up cigarette butts outside the meetings or cleaning ashtrays because many of the guys were smoking and the ladies were smoking at that time. And I took commitments also in the central office, answering phones, doing things, and also in the step studies. And I got very deep into that. And it really has transformed my life, because I began to realize that this behavior modification, or cognitive behavior modification, is really what essentially is going to help me restructure the architecture of my synaptic connections in my brain, that new pathways are going to develop as a result of this new behavior that's going to make me see things differently and make me respond and react to things in my life differently. And it's an old axiom that Karl Marx actually had written way back in the 1840s in his critique of Feuerbach. He said that it is not the consciousness of an individual that shapes his social being. It is rather his social being that shapes his consciousness, or his morality and moral values and so on. And in AA parlance, they say that you cannot think yourself into a sober way of living. You have to soberly live your life into a sober way of thinking. And it's really the same thing that is related to praxis, is directed to work, to action being taken that actually can reshape a person's consciousness or a person's perception of things. And in quantum physics, they say that when you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. And it's basically that same concept of change taking place. And change really is precisely what it's all about. Because if I were unwilling to change, and I heard that very often in the meetings, if I was unwilling to change and remained the same Ralph who came into Alcoholics Anonymous on August 4th of 99, I would drink. The same Ralph would drink. So that something had to change within me, a sense of a community, a sense of belonging, a sense of being a part of, and the opposite of the isolation and the separation that I was, the prison really that I had built around myself, which is that thick shell of my egoic mind, as some would call it, or the ego, the thick shell that was separating me from the rest of the universe, had to crack open. And I think with involvement, with activities, with showing up, especially going on panels to all kinds of places, it has been extremely helpful. And then I began to go to retreats also. And I'm as agnostic, as atheist as I ever was. And the older I get, the more science reveals new discoveries about life and about this universe, and the more I'm convinced of the rationale of scientific thinking and skeptical thinking or skeptic thinking. But I do go to retreats because I have found that I have learned to meditate of all places at a Japanese Zen, not Zen, at a Japanese temple where this old monk taught us how to do breathing meditation, contemplative meditation, working meditation, walking meditation. And he explained that you could be a school teacher, and if your heart is in it and you're conveying the message to your students, you're in meditation. If you're a gardener or a cook, cooking a dish for your friends or helping your family for a dinner, with your heart and your mind focused on the meal you're preparing, you're in meditation. That is also meditation, etc. So I've taken a liking to those retreats because it gives me a chance to actually practice meditation and calm living and peace of mind. I am able now to fall asleep within 5 minutes of lying down. I learned how to do it, and I had to ask how, and ask people who have experienced that how to do it. How do I learn to put myself to sleep and not be stuck with recurring thoughts or loops all night long, and be unable to sleep, and then the next morning be tired and be exhausted because the machine took over the body. And how can I calm it down? How can I put it in neutral? And I think the inventory that I have taken to find out who I am, to find out more about who I am, and the amends I've had to made had to make to people helped me be able to walk freely as a free human being, having gotten rid of all this garbage that I was carrying on my back for so many years. It's been really a wonderful experience. I've had some tough times, some difficulties. I sponsored some friends, and they call them friends, I don't call them sponsees, but I don't really believe in any kind of hierarchy at all. We're all alcoholics, we're all sober human beings, and grateful to be sober. We all have 24 hours, and that's about the size of it. The highest rank in AA is a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's it. There is no higher ranking. And my wife used to tell me, "How come this friend of yours is sober, this friend, and our son is not?" I had a son who was battling drug addiction and alcoholism, in and out of jail and prison for years, or almost 20 years. He's now sober, about 2 years and a few months, and he's out of prison. He's working, and he's got a good posse of sober alcoholics around him. And for that, I am very, very grateful to my friends in AA and to the friends he has found in this 12-step program that have helped him stay sober. And he is now working the step. In fact, before joining this meeting, I was at a meeting that he attends called the Stags of Sobriety, or SOS, in Canoga Park. And it's wonderful to see that he has commitments in the meeting, and that he has his sponsor, and he has sponsees, and he's showing up at panels and doing stuff like that. I love that. I went to panels to prisons, to Tehachapi, many, many times, and I've enjoyed the retreats that I have attended in Alcoholics Anonymous. I just came from one a few weeks ago out in Malibu. It was absolutely fantastic, with the 50 other guys. And before that, in July, I was in the retreat with 90 other guys in Serra retreat in Malibu. It's in a monastery, a Franciscan monastery, and the guy who led the retreat was a priest. They even had some time for people to come and confess and talk to him. But he's a sober guy. He's got over 40 years of sobriety. And I had lunch and dinner with him a couple of times, and I told him I'm a devout atheist. I don't believe in souls and in ghosts or in Santa Claus or leprechauns or stuff like that. But it is what it is. I told him I have deep respect for his sobriety and for his deeds, for his actions. He's helping tremendously lots of people. And for that, I'm very grateful. I go to AA meetings where the Lord's Prayer is read, and sometimes I recite it with them. And not that I believe any word of it, but I'm happy for those who do, and I'm happy for those who are staying sober and who think that that helps them. Alcoholics Anonymous has been an absolutely wonderful thing for me and for my wife. My wife and I celebrated in September 50 years. That's 5-0, 50 years of marriage. And my son, who's now sober, and my daughter, who has been sober for an awful long time, were with us. And I attribute the length of my wedlock or marriage to my wife to Alcoholics Anonymous. I made amends to her first and foremost, but also to my daughter and my son, because I'm sober and because I know I know my problems, and I remember last time last year in 2022, I went to Carson City, Nevada, where my son was incarcerated for a parole hearing. I wrote a letter in support of him. He told me he had been sober for a few months. I wrote a letter and I passed it by some friends in Los Angeles who were probation officers and asked them what they think. They made some suggestions. I made some corrections, and I submitted the letter. And I showed up there in Carson City, and we were on Zoom. My son was on Zoom. He was in his prison cell and with somebody. And I was in the parole board with some people there. They asked me if I had something to add. I told them, yeah, I want to address my son and tell him that I love him. And I'm ha very happy he's sober, and I'm very happy he has changed his life. And I told the board also that one of the reasons I am here, and I didn't put that in writing in the letter, is because this is part of my amends to my son, because I know that when he was a young teenager, a young kid, and I was drinking, I was not the best father that to be. And I know that because I was drinking, I did not provide him with the ideal setting for raising a young man. And for that, I am very sorry. And I am here to make amends, living amends, and wish him the best. And he cried. He broke down and cried in his prison cell. And not very common to see a man cry in prison, but he was very touched. And he wrote me a long letter after that to thank me. He was released shortly thereafter. Folks, I am sorry if I've gone too long. I'm going to shut up with that and wish you all the best. I was just going to say, I was going to read one thing. It's actually from, it's I found lots of fun in poetry that applies to Alcoholics Anonymous. One of them is from T.S. Eliot's Little Gidding in the fourth quartet. He says, "We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. Through the unknown, unremembered gate, where the last of earth left to discover is that which was the beginning, at the source of the longest river, the voice of the hidden waterfall, and the children in the apple tree, not known because not looked for, but heard, half heard, in the stillness between two waves in the sea." That step 10 had continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. That's really what he's talking about, the exploration that is unceasing. And I find that to be very, very helpful. The last thing I'm going to say is from Alfred Lord Tennyson in Ulysses. He says, "I am a part," and it is about the unity. "I am a part of all that I have met. Yet all experience is an arch where through gleams that untraveled world, whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use." And I think that's very important to remain active and to remain involved, not to shine in use, is a waste of time. Thank you all for listening to me. Thank you for allowing me to speak. And thank you, Bridget.